Once you gain the confidence and the skill to be in the project world, you have freedom. You're going to need that freedom because the system is going to let you down. The system is going to treat you like a cog. It's going to undermine you and disrespect you. It might not do that today, but it's going to do it soon. And the best way to avoid that is to know how to make projects.
Welcome to Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change. I'm Ludvig Sundström.
And I'm Mikael Syding.
Today, we talk to Seth Godin, who is a serial entrepreneur, author, and one of the world's biggest experts on marketing. Seth has written as many as 18 best-selling books. His writing is about the post-industrial revolution, the way ideas spread, marketing, leadership, and how change happens. His new book is called This Is Marketing. Seth is also the founder of Alt MBA and The Marketing Seminar, two very successful online workshops, and he also has one of the world's most popular blogs. Seth has had a really interesting career, I think, and today we discuss some of his different business projects, like The Worlds of Power, which is a book series that has sold more than 1 million copies, and we also heard what it was like to work with Isaac Asimov. Three big takeaways from our conversation are that you should start a blog, even if it's anonymous, because this is a great creative medium, and everyone, to some extent, should be engaged in a creative medium as a long-term investment into their career and personal development. Second, all major industries become rebundled, that is, they become changed from the ground up about every 10 to 20 years. And finally, marketing is about creating stories that spread and drive change. So without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Ludvig. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's nice to finally meet you. Well, digitally.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
So how's New York?
Well, finally, it's not 4,000 degrees, but I fear that the world is melting. So I try not to judge a day by the weather.
Okay. How did you spend the summer?
Inside, writing, working on my new book, running some schools. Every once in a while, when the heat breaks, taking my dog for a long walk.
So what were you like as a kid?
I think most people would say I was annoying.
Would you say that you're motivated by the same things now that you were as a kid?
Well, I think I'm less annoying now than when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I was really curious. And I developed this cycle of making assertions. And I think that that's something that's missing from the way most people do their work. Being able to imagine an outcome that could make things better, describing it to other people and saying, I think if we did this, that would happen. And they try to boil that out of us when we're kids in Europe, in the United States, and in Asia. But I think that's a big mistake. So in many ways, I'm the same in that I continue to make assertions, but I would like to think that I do it in a less annoying way now.
All right. This is Michael. I listened to your Akimbo episode where you got lost on Lake Erie.
Yes.
That sounded very much like a mature and resourceful kid. Would you agree?
Yes, I was very mature and very resourceful. People said that sometimes I acted like an adult when I was a kid, which is one way to be annoying. The reason I use the word annoying is because I didn't set out to annoy people, but I was confronting systems that I saw to be inadequate. And what I hadn't learned yet is how to engage with inadequate systems in a way that can cause those systems to improve. And if you're 10 or 12 or 14 and merely narrating the inadequate systems around you, that's not particularly helpful.
How would you describe your work right now? So you said that you will get used to working with assertions early, but do you feel like this is kind of like an arc that's gone across all of your life? But obviously your work must have changed.
Well, you know, in college, I studied to be a mechanical engineer and computer scientist. And the thing about mechanical engineering and computers is there are right answers. There are answers that are better than others, but there are definitely answers that are wrong. And the challenge that engineers have in the real world is they forget that humanity kicks in. And if you don't count the humanity part, your right answer is useless. So being an entrepreneur, I sort of juxtapose this sense of a designer's mindset, who's it for, what's it for, with the softer side of what is the story the user is going to tell herself? And how does that story resonate in a way that can cause forward motion to happen?
So how did you make the transition from mechanical engineer into a marketer? Because you've now been inducted into both of these very big nominations for the Marketing Hall of Fame and the Direct Marketing Hall of Fame, correct?
That's true. I think it began in non-illustrious ways, which is that I wasn't particularly good at engineering. I wasn't good at it because I didn't have the patience for the last sigma of accuracy. I wanted to get the basic idea and then move on. And what I discovered is that marketing, the act of telling a story that makes change happen, has way more leverage than the typical work of a mechanical engineer. Whereas a mechanical engineer who comes up with the right answer gets it nowhere if she's not able to market it. So I discovered that marketing was shifting from let's run some ads, which worked great in 1970, to let's build something worth talking about. Let's engage with people who want us to engage with them. And that combination of change and humanity has always resonated with me.
But from my understanding, you quickly realized that you didn't want to have a traditional career. You wanted to do creative projects.
Well, I had the greatest job in the world when I was in Boston. And so for 2 years, I got to do projects and I didn't have to worry about the P&L because I didn't own the company. And that was magical for me because I spent almost no time losing sleep over making payroll and all of my time inventing and organizing and running and launching projects. And that's what I've always wanted to do. And I didn't need to have an upside and I didn't need to own it. But what I discovered after I moved to New York is that the number of places where I could get a job doing that was zero. So I had to build my own job doing that and I've been doing it ever since.
But now the world is a bit different. Now it's easier to become a freelancer or work on your own projects, especially with marketing and the internet.
Oh, it's 10,000 times easier, but it's still extremely difficult. And so my soapbox is to say to people, one, find a project, then find another project, and then find another project. Find it in your spare time if you need to, but find a project. Because once you gain the confidence and the skill to be in the project world, you have freedom. And you're going to need that freedom because the system is going to let you down. The system is going to treat you like a cog. It's going to undermine you and disrespect you. It might not do that today, but it's going to do it soon. And the best way to avoid that is to know how to make projects.
So would you say that both a formal education and a traditional career, that you definitely should avoid those, or do they have a role at all?
Well, I think they have a huge role if you can engage in them efficiently. I think we can agree that going 20 million euro in debt to get a college degree is foolish. But there is some number at which a college degree is quite worth it in time and money. That I hope we can agree that there are jobs where people are given a chance to become their best selves. If you can get one of those jobs, you should take it. My point is that we live in a world in flux and you don't need to be a victim. That when the world presents opportunities to you that align with your goals, take them. But don't feel like you have no choice, because now more than ever, you have a choice.
I feel like one of the most interesting things about you is your breadth. You've done so many different things. And that's something that appeals to me very much. So I would like to talk a little bit about your 30 years of projects. And particularly two of these projects are interesting to me. The first one is the Worlds of Power. I would like to know, how did you get all the licenses for these popular video games?
Okay, so here was the idea. I was a book packager, which means my job was to come up with ideas for books, find a publisher, and then do all of the hard work of making the book so that it could actually be real. Because, you know, a novel doesn't work that way, but an almanac certainly does. You can't make an almanac all by yourself. So I did a few almanacs. I did dozens and dozens of books on a wide range of topics. And then I discovered that my cousin, who at the time was 11, had never read a book for fun in his entire life. And this really bothered me. It bothered me that we were being surrounded by kids coming up, growing up, this is before the internet, who had never read a book for fun. And I said to him, "Well, Eric, what do you do for fun?" And he showed me his video game collection. Well, I was one of the very first persons to ever novelize a computer game. So I realized that novelization, which is where you take a movie and write a book about it, could be done to video games. So that was a great idea. But then I said, how am I going to get the rights to these video games? Well, at the time, Nintendo made 60 or 70% of all the video games. But Nintendo was very conservative and didn't want to license me the rights to their games. But there were the other 30% of the companies, and they were all underdogs. They all had a chip on their shoulder because they were trying to compete with Nintendo. So I went to these folks and I said, here's the deal. I'll promote your game for free, okay? And they said, sure, because It didn't cost him anything. I didn't pay him anything either. I just gave them 100 copies of the book when I was done. And they realized that when they sold one more copy of a video game, they made $50 or $40. Whereas if I paid them a royalty on a book where my share was a dollar, they would have made 10 cents. They weren't stupid. They said, the publicity is worth way more than the royalties. Yeah, make a book, sell a million copies. It'll help us. So that's what we did.
Were you surprised when it sold more than a million copies?
Well, part of what it means to be in the project business is that you're an incurable optimist, that every project is the one that's going to work. And it's not that I was surprised when it sold a million copies. It's that I was surprised that all the other projects didn't sell a million copies. That, you wake up in the morning optimistic and you go to bed every night a realist, and then you start again tomorrow.
There's another project that I also think is really interesting, and that's... It's called a Quicklit, right?
Yes.
And this one, however, didn't go as well. And I would like you to tell us...
It was close.
Yeah? Okay.
It was really close.
All right. I would like to know two things. First, what was the time difference? How long... This was after, right?
Yeah, it was probably... I don't know which one came first. I mean, I could look it up, but people don't want to wait for me to walk over to my bookshelf and do that. So what happened was, in the US, people are lazy, and there was a company called Cliff's Notes. And Cliff's Notes sold millions of copies of 60 to 80 page digests of the books that got assigned in school. And the idea was, no, don't bother reading Beowulf or Moby Dick. Just read the summary and your teacher won't be able to tell the difference, and you can go back to hanging out with your friends. Well, the people at Cliff's Notes published a list to the booksellers of their top 30 best-selling Cliff's Notes. And that was a big deal because there was no Amazon, so there was no way to know what their bestsellers were, but they told them. And the reason they told them was because they wanted the booksellers to make sure they kept those 30 in stock. So I said, why don't I just take all 30 and put them in one book? Cliff's Notes of Cliff's Notes. So if you're really lazy, you don't need an 80-page digest. I'll give you a 7-page digest. And I'll give you 30 of these in one book for the price of 2 Cliff's Notes. It was an irresistible offer. And so we caused the book to get made. I worked with a bunch of college students to make it. And building it wasn't easy, but we got it done. And the book came out and it did not do very well at all. And I realized why after the fact. And here's the reason. The reason is, the person who goes in and buys a Cliff's Note, at least in those days, was saying to himself, only this one time. Only once am I going to buy a Cliff's Note. The rest of the time, I'm an amazing student. So when you say to this person, here's all 30, they're like, what do you think I am, lazy? I just need one. So we were really close. We were a little ahead of our time, but it was a fascinating project.
Yeah, because I think there is a book now, at least one, with 80 summarizations. And there's even a service, I think, you subscribe to these things. So you probably were just early, simply.
Better than late, I guess.
But you also worked with Isaac Asimov, right?
Yes, Isaac and I did a project together, and one of the highlights of my career. I started reading his work when I was 8 years old, so meeting him in person was quite a thrill. What we did was, Peter Alotka and I invented the idea of using a VCR tape, which is inherently linear, to create a parlor game, a game you could play with your family over and over again. And the way the game worked is you would watch this video, and every 6 or 7 minutes, you'd stop the video and play a clue card. And the clue card had a clue on one side or the other. And there were 8 clue cards. So 2^8 power is 256. So there are 256 combinations of clue cards. And every combination led to a different outcome of who committed the murder in this murder mystery. It was a really cool idea, and we needed to figure out what to make the movie about. So we made the movie about Isaac Asimov's Robots universe. So I was able to work with him on bringing his characters into this format. And in the US, Siskel and Ebert gave it 2 thumbs up. It was a good try. It was fun to make. But again, it was a project that got close, but didn't become a home run. But the beauty of being in the project business is that's okay, because you make enough money to make another project.
Did you happen to talk a lot of sci-fi and artificial intelligence and stuff like that with him as well? Or is that something you've gotten into later?
Well, we talked about the fact that he was afraid of flying. And we talked about the way he got so much writing done. AI was a little, it was very unusual even for science fiction writers to be talking too much about AI in those days. Because remember, we were just at the beginning of personal computers, and they were mostly a toy. And so the idea that people would spend 7 hours a day with their smartphone the way they do now, even if a science fiction author wrote about that in those days, they were viewed as a little bit of a crank. So Isaac was spending most of his time thinking about spaceships, space operas. He also wrote a lot about science and things that were true today, but computers weren't really his thing.
I listened to your episode on Akimbo, once again, where you were talking about the relationship between companies and clients. And in it, you had an example about an airline, what they should do when there is a delay. Do you remember that?
Yeah, the idea is that customer service has been a reactive process since the beginning. You buy something in a store, it doesn't work, you bring it back. You call up an 800 number, you tell them what you want. You visit a website, et cetera. But with artificial intelligence, there isn't a call center anymore. The artificial intelligence is with us everywhere we go because it's cheap to put it inside the device. So the example I gave when I spoke at IBM about Watson is my Prius knows that every time I try to do certain things with the radio, it doesn't work. I'm pressing buttons. It's not working. Well, if it knows that and it knows what I should do, it should tell me or it should call me. It doesn't need me to go find its phone number and call them. They should call me. And the example I gave in Akimbo is if a flight is canceled, the airline knows everything it needs to know about every person on that flight to proactively help people without first stressing everybody out, then having everyone call them, and then have everyone identify who they are and take blah, blah, blah. We know from Google that there's a lot of snooping going on. So why aren't they snooping on my behalf, right? So the argument I made in the podcast is, all right, there's 45 people on the plane. At 10:04 a.m., the pilot announces that she's canceling the flight. So at 10:05 a.m., everyone's phone should ring and it should say, hey, it's United Airlines. I know your flight just got canceled. Is it okay if I put you on a new flight? Because it knows who I am. It knows where I'm going. It knows where all the other flights are already. Why is it up to me? Why isn't customer service proactive?
Do you have any idea why they don't do that? Because it's been possible and simple even for several years.
Well, so now this is where we get back to where we started our conversation about the juxtaposition between humanity and technology, about storytelling. The kind of person who goes to work at an airline probably, I'm generalizing here, took a job where there was a job, where they were told what to do next. That the very nature of airlines is keep the schedule, don't crash. That's what they do. And if you think about innovations in air travel, there have been very, very few of them. There was the frequent flyer miles. And then I'm having trouble thinking of the next big one since then. That there aren't a lot of people sitting around saying, how can I dramatically change the customer experience here? And that's because what we do every day when we go to work is we tell ourselves a story about who we are and what will make us happy. And the idea of launching something that might not work in an industry that's based on this will work, that's a stretch. That's why certain industries have more innovation than other ones.
So you think they should redefine their own narrative and maybe also the purpose of why they go to work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when if you read enough Harvard Business School case studies, what you discover is that the real winners arise in every industry when the paradigm is shifted. And Ted Levitt talked about this in 1962 with marketing myopia, which was, shouldn't Penn Central, the big railroad line in the United States, instead of going out of business, become an airline? Well, of course they should have, because they weren't in the train business. They were in the transportation of people business. Once you redefine what you do, it changes things. So if you think about what does Delta Airlines do, what does Lufthansa do? Well, there's a bunch of jobs. One job is own the planes. One job is manage the union. One job is deal with the airports. One job is deal with I mean, there's this long list of jobs. And it's just a coincidence that they've all been bundled together the way we see them now. But when paradigms shift, the bundles get disrupted. So in the case of Uber, they said, we're going to be a taxi company, but we're not going to own any taxis and we're not going to hire any drivers. We're going to unbundle and then rebundle. And I think it's inevitable that every industry gets rebundled every generation or two. And that's likely to happen for the airlines.
Okay. So this is, speaking of paradigms, this is something that I know you've talked about too. Ronald Coase's The Nature of the Firm. So how do you see the new kind of enterprise, the future enterprise of maybe the next 10, 20 years, evolving now with the sharing economy and distribution being shifted? What are some of your thoughts on that?
So, you know, Coase's argument was firms come together when it's more efficient than when they're apart. So if everyone's sharing the same assembly line, that's more efficient than having people build it in their cottage. Well, that seems intuitive. But it's not intuitive anymore for Ernst & Young to have 140,000 employees. I mean, they have more employees than live in a typical city. How is that helpful, right? It's not helpful. What they really need to own is not the full day of each employee, but the data about who people are, what they're good at, and what their relationship to other people are. That owning the network, the platform, way more efficient, way quicker, way more nimble than saying, we're going to be one of the largest employers in the world, because this doesn't help them. The nature of the firm is changing. So I think that, you know, I know that the people who are excited about blockchain aren't excited about it because of cryptocurrency. They're excited about it because it gives us this understanding in the shared database of who's who, what's what, who knows who, and that getting our arms around that as we enter the connection economy and leave the industrial economy is where an enormous amount of value is going to get unlocked.
What kind of decisions do you think that either as a business owner or as a young person who wants to have a good career, what kind of decisions should you think about extra carefully now that the value chain is changing?
Most of us are never going to own a $1 billion public company or run one. We're more likely to be small players in a big game of change. And so as small players, I think we need to think like bootstrappers. In September, we're launching something called the Bootstrappers Workshop. And the theory behind it is that there's one kind of business where you're a freelancer. You just wait for someone to hire you to do a job. There's another kind of business where you're an entrepreneur with a capital E, where you are raising a lot of money, hiring a lot of people, and then selling it for a lot of money when you're done. But in between is this idea of being a bootstrapper. And a bootstrapper builds a project bigger than herself. She does it with other people's money, but that money comes from her customers, because she's building a platform, a connection, an opportunity that her customers want more than they want the money in their pocket. And so our ability going forward to redefine what it means to have a firm and to say, well, what I really have is a Rolodex. What I really know how to do is bring trusted people together to create connection, to solve a problem, and I can do it faster and more reliably than other people. Well, you can do that all day long. And you can do that without a building, and you can do that without a lot of money, because you are the impresario, you are the maker of change.
So if I enroll in the Bootstrappers, what will I learn?
Well, I think that there's the courses that I run have two elements to them. One element to them is, here is some information, but I'll tell you the truth, all that information is already on my blog for free. The information is not the reason to take a course anymore. The second thing that we do is we give people a safe place to act as if. We connect them to their peers. We establish circles of community and connection so that you can talk to other people on the same journey and not feel crazy. We create peer pressure so that if you are tempted to hide, your peers will say, where are you? We need you here. And it's this emotional and social and even moral element that makes the courses I run work so well. Because I'm not in them. There's video of me sometimes, but I'm not sitting there cheering each person on individually. What I've done is create a place where people move forward. So if you take the Bootstrappers Workshop, which is at boot.work, what you will do is find yourself making lists of dozens and dozens of the kinds of enterprises that you could build. What you will find yourself doing is engaging with other people who are doing the same thing and giving each other positive and helpful feedback about how to do it better. What you will do is prototype the kind of thing you can build, understand the assets that you'll be creating, and act as if, and maybe even get started. And that would be the big win. It's only 3 weeks of intense back and forth, but it's open for 100 days. You know, we just finished the Podcaster Fellowship today, and the magic of it was that dozens and dozens of people who didn't have a podcast now have one. And we didn't teach them anything about making a podcast that they didn't know. What we did was open the door for them to do what they wanted to do all along.
That sounds great. And I know that, for example, you have the marketing seminar, and you have a bunch of courses on Udemy, and your courses are some of the most successful and popular in the whole world. So I'm wondering what goes into your mind when before you get started, before you finish it. What do you think about to make it successful?
When we started the Alt MBA, the discipline that I needed to bring to it was not to use the tools that generally have worked for me in the past, which is showing up in someone's face with positive, generous energy. Because I know how to do that. I've been doing it from the stage for a long time. I've been a teacher since I was 17. But I don't get to do that online. So the discipline was, don't use that as a glue to hold it together. Find something else. And what makes these courses work is that I had the guts to trust my students. And that's not usually what happens. Like, the Udemy courses are fun. And if that's what works for you, I hope you'll take them. But that's just me talking. That's the way all Udemy courses work. And they're easy for students to do, but they don't usually cause students to change because you're just watching a TV show and you're like, oh, yeah. But then you go back to hiding. And so my mission is not to get big. My mission is not even to be profitable. My mission is to make change happen. And so if these courses can do that, then we're going to keep using those techniques to make it happen. And I don't care if 100 people take it or 5,000 people take it. We want the experience to be that it's breathtaking, that you find something inside of yourself that you didn't know was there.
Well, you're obviously doing quite well with that. I would like to know, what's the difference between the Alt MBA and the Udemy courses?
So the Alt MBA has no video in it at all. It has coaches. We have 90 coaches we've trained around the world. You've got people from 45 countries who are working 2 or 3 hours a day, every day, for a month in a workshop. There's 12 or 13 projects. You do a new project every 2 or 3 days. You are writing, posting, responding, giving feedback, getting feedback, and then repeating the process. You're in study groups, you're in video chat rooms, and you're being coached. So we straight up are saying to people, we will change you. That's what we do here. And if you want content, well, we link to content, but none of the content we link to is proprietary. Here, we're organizing this place to change you. A Udemy course is, if you came to my office and listened to me teach you for 5 hours, that's a Udemy course. And so they couldn't be more different. And each one serves a different function for a different kind of person.
Okay. Well, would you say that one of the most important elements of the success in the Alt MBA is in the selection of the correct students so that you get like a good group of people together?
Well, yeah. I mean, the secret, of course, is that we're cheating, and we cheat by having the right people in the room. Because when the right people are in the room, everyone feels like everyone else knows something they don't know. And everyone feels like everyone else is going just a little faster than they are. And Sam Miller, our operations head, is responsible for curating all of the applications that we get. And it matters. You know, we've got 2,600 alumni. They travel all over the world to meet each other. They keep in touch. They start businesses with each other. And that's because the right people raise their hand and say, yeah, I'd like to do this.
All right. That's cool. Thanks for explaining. I haven't been part of the Alt MBA, but I've read about it. And I was really curious to try it, but I didn't have the guts to do it while I was still in university.
Well, no time like the present. Our last session of the year is happening soon. We don't run it that often, only 4 times a year. But if people are interested, I hope they'll check it out. If it's not for them, totally get it. But if it is, I hope you'll look more closely at it.
Could we talk a bit about marketing and your new book?
I'd be delighted. It's called This is Marketing. It comes out November 13th in countries around the world. And basically, it's my first full-length book about marketing in almost 10 years. And what I have tried to do is capture the essence of what I've learned in 30 years of doing this. Not to give people a map, because maps go out of date, but to give people a compass to say, this direction, this posture, this is working. This is how ideas are spreading. And so it's the opposite of the model of yelling at people or bullying people or worrying about what the hot new trend is. This is marketing that works for nonprofits, for individuals, for big companies and small ones to make a change happen.
Okay, so would you say that this is more like a continuation of the theme that you've put forth before, or does it differ from your other books that I've read, for example, like The Purple Cow, Tribes, Idea Virus, All Marketers Are Liars, and some more? Is it different, or is it more like a continuation of the same theme?
Well, it's a continuation, but there are some very big new ideas in it that came out of the marketing seminar that we run, because I got to watch 6,000 people learn marketing inside the seminar. I saw where they got stuck. I saw the lessons that resonated. So the book covers things like status roles and tension, ideas like affiliation and dominance, positioning as a service, all of this stuff that I thought everyone understood that they didn't. And by laying that out, what I have found is that people develop a whole new understanding for how things work.
Would you say that in this new book, This is Marketing, that the ideas are so generally applicable that you can use them on the smallest and the biggest companies alike? Or have you somehow shown which ideas are working for smaller companies, which ideas are working for services companies and other from manufacturing companies and so on? Or is this the collection of ideas that work for every marketing situation?
Well, I am hesitant to say the word every, but I will tell you that I've been in a little tiny village in India that had no electricity. And I told that story on how it worked there. And I look at the rise of a, you know, autocrat in another country at a huge scale and how it works there and everything in between. I think I can explain how some nonprofits raise money and other ones fail, how doctors can persuade people to take their medicine or not. So it's pretty universal. I've seen it work in countries that come from a capitalist background and countries that don't. So I don't think there's a lot of special cases inside this body of work. I think what I'm trying to do is universalize it because it's about humanity. It's about helping to change people.
And who would you say your specific target group is? Is this like for students, for advanced entrepreneurs, or for entrepreneur wannabes?
You know, at the beginning of the book, I say, here's how you can tell if you have a marketing problem. You have a marketing problem if you're not getting the respect you think you deserve, if you're not causing the change to happen that you seek, if you're not being noticed enough, and if you're not having enough impact. So if none of those things are true for you, you don't need this book. But everybody else has a marketing problem. And the best way to solve a marketing problem is to understand how marketing works.
And do all marketers lie? Do you lie?
Okay, so that was a terrible title. And I learned a really good lesson about terrible titles. If you read the book, then the joke is yes. All good marketing is storytelling, and all stories are different from the absolute value of truth. That there's a story that says, this bridge feels safe. I'm going to drive across it. That is very different from the tensile analysis and the finite math systems analysis of all the struts on the bridge that prove it's safe. Those are two different things. The first one is what we need to do if we want people to drive across the bridge. That is telling a story. And stories are inherently, quote, lies, unquote, in that they are not a bullet list of engineering facts. So by saying all marketers are liars, I'm not saying all marketers are bad people who should be untrusted. I am saying, if you want to be a good marketer, tell a better story. A story, it turns out, that's true. Because a true story is a story that holds up over time. It's a story you don't regret believing. That when we tell true stories that resonate with people, that are worth sharing, then we're being a professional marketer.
How do you get really good stories or ideas to spread?
Well, I'm hearing two parts to that question. First, how do you get a good story? And then the second one is, how do you get it to spread? And my answer is, if it's a good story, it's going to spread because that's part of what makes it a good story. What makes it a good story is really difficult to figure out in advance. Mostly, it begins with saying to somebody, you were right all along. That thing you believe, that thing you want, that innate view you have of the world, I'm here to tell you that you were right all along. And perhaps you might want to do X, Y, or Z about it. So if you think about political arguments, most of the time when we have a political argument, we bring facts to the table and we argue that the other side must see our facts and change what they believe. But real change happens when we bring a story to the table that matches the story the person already believes, that causes them to embrace the facts on the ground and run with them. And that act of doing it, you know, how do you get someone to drive a Harley Davidson motorcycle? How do you get someone to take their tuberculosis medicine? How do you get someone to quit smoking? They go back to our primeval nature of wanting to believe a way of being in the world. And then if we turn it in one direction or another, we can change their behavior. So a teenager, if you go to a teenager and say, don't smoke because in 70 years you'll die, that's true. But teenagers live their lives not caring what's going to happen in 70 years. But if we go to a teenager and say, you want to be cool, athletes are cool, you can't be on the team if you smoke cigarettes. That gets people to stop smoking.
Okay, so like two important aspects or maybe differences between an amateur marketer and someone who is a professional or really good at it is you have to understand people and you have to understand what kind of stories and ideas spread.
And you have to have the empathy to permit the person you're talking to believe stuff that you know is not true.
Yeah, you talked about the word Sonder. Was it today as well? Because I listened to three episodes today, so I can't really tell them apart. But
I don't think it was today. Sonder is the magical act of believing, understanding, realizing that everyone else has a noise in their head, just like you have a noise in your head. That everybody else has their own internal narrative, just like you do. Because most people don't do that. Most people think we're the only one who's dealing with that noise, and everyone else is some sort of magical robot, that if we just gave them enough good input, we'd get good output. And as soon as you can find the empathy to understand that other people are afraid or angry or insecure or greedy or whatever, then you find the room to let them become who they need to become.
How did you pick that word up? I mean, it's an interesting concept, and it's interesting in terms of empathy and marketing, but I'm also curious as how did you pick that word up? Because it's a poet who came up with a dictionary of obscure sorrows, I think.
Right, exactly.
And that's where it comes from.
Right. Someone needed to invent the word, and they did. I get a lot of input in my life because I don't go to meetings and I don't watch television. There's plenty of time for me to notice things. And that was just something that crossed my desk. And I was like, whoa, yeah, this, I wish I'd invented this word. This word needs to be invented. So I blogged it. And it resonated with people, so I keep talking about it.
Yeah, and I've been reading that book, and it's very hard to stop. He's come up with a lot of fantastic concepts that just needed a word.
Yeah, it's not easy work to do, nor is it easy to get compensated for, but I'm glad it's getting done.
How much do you read, by the way, in terms of books? Do you read a set amount of books every week, or?
I get a lot of inbound, so I usually can, in just a couple chapters, get the joke and decide if I want to pursue it or not. It's harder and harder in our culture to carve out the hours it takes to read a book because we've been trained to get that endorphin hit from email instead. I know that it has changed the way I write. My writing delivers a little bit of an email wallop to people about every three paragraphs. And if you're not used to that, it's not the same as reading a book like Faulkner or whatever. I'm nowhere near that category because I'm trying to write for a modern reader. And so I've learned so much from books, but I've also found my patience waning because I just have trouble saying, yep, I'm just going to sit here for the next 12 pages before I figure out what they're talking about.
Okay, so let's do some closing questions and talk about the future. First one, how do you see the future of marketing developing?
Well, you know, the future is here, and it's no more gatekeepers, very little curation, lots of peer-to-peer. It's about rising distrust at the same time we have rising tribal identification. And the original idea of permission marketing remains as strong as ever, which is who is going to listen to you? Who is going to trust you? That's being atomized all over the place, but it's still urgently important.
I think you have probably one of the most popular blogs in the world, and you know a lot about the topic too. So I'm wondering, would you recommend basically anyone listening to this to start a blog from scratch and do it long term like you've done to build up an audience and get trust from people?
Well, I'm going to say yes to the first part and maybe to the second part. Everyone should have a blog, even if they're going to write it under an assumed name, even if they don't need anyone to read it. The act of writing the blog is priceless, and there's no argument against it. Everyone should do that from the age of 7. Should you bet a lot of time and money on building up a big audience and trust? Well, I think it depends on what you do. If I was a yoga instructor, yeah, I would definitely do that. If I was somebody who was trying to invent a replacement for high efficiency LED bulbs and I needed, 80 important people in the industry to trust me, yes, I would do that. But if you don't need to engage with a public, then no, you probably don't need to do the second part. But it doesn't cost anything and it's so beneficial. It's hard for me to see why someone wouldn't do it.
In your podcast, Akimbo, you talk a lot about changing the culture and change in general. And I'm wondering, why do you think people are so resistant towards change?
Because they don't want to become extinct. Every animal is resistant to change. Every animal that's ever evolved views change as a threat because it is a threat. That if you're a bird used to a certain weather conditions and the weather conditions start to change, that's not good. That's bad. And it's only an accident that the last thousand years of our culture have been about ever quickening change. That's new, and we're hardwired to hate that. And so I'm not surprised that people don't like change. My argument is I'm not the person who's responsible for the change. The change is happening. So since the change is happening, the question is, what will you do about it?
And probably one of the most important things is to proactively become more adaptable towards change and open yourself up to new ideas rather than resisting it. And one thing that you talk about here is the lizard brain. And I want to ask you, how can we overcome this amygdala slavery?
You can't overcome the amygdala. You cannot overcome the lizard. The fact is resilience is difficult because the primeval part of our brain hijacks all of our frontal cortex every time it feels threatened. And the magic here is not to spend a lot of time fighting with our fear, but instead to dance with it, to use it as a compass, to build up the muscle that says, when I start feeling that feeling of flight, of fear, of anger, don't try to damp it down. Instead, welcome it and use it as a compass to say, oh, thanks for letting me know I'm on the right track.
How are you personally preparing for the future that you see?
That is a great question. You know, one of the things that's different when you're 30 than when you're 60 is that when you're 30, it feels like a roller coaster. And when you're 60, it feels like airplane turbulence. And people don't usually pay money for airplane turbulence. So what I try to do is drop the narrative and engage with the feeling. Oh, that happened. What am I going to do? Not how do I stop things from happening? That figuring out how to accept things, not because we want them, but because they're here, frees us up to put more work into the change we seek to make.
Final question. Where can people reach you? And is there a final thing that you want people to check out?
If you go to seths.blog, there's 7,000 posts. Type Seth into your favorite search engine. There I am. The Alt MBA is at altmba.com. Bootstrappers Workshop is boot.work. And we'll run the next session of the marketing seminar in January. And in the meantime, the book, This is Marketing, you can find on my blog as well.
All right. Thanks so much for being on the show. And yeah, it's awesome to talk to you.
Thank you both for doing this work. And I really appreciate the effort you put into it. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to our conversation with Seth Godin, and thank you to Alexander Martin, who edits our episodes. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter for weekly summaries and a lot of other cool things. You can do this at www.futureskillspodcast.com/newsletter. And there's always a link in the bottom of our episode descriptions for this too that you can see. Thanks for listening to Future Skills, and we'll see you next week.